From the Atypical Podcast, it's the One Thing series. Discussions with dreamers, doers, thinkers, and catalysts, where they tell their story as well as the one thing that shaped their life or work and made them who they are. What is that belief or epiphany or occurrence in their life that so entrenched itself that it changed their trajectory? I'm Matt Mooney.
And I'm Jenny Mooney.
And this is The One Thing. If you think about where you live, most likely you don't consider 10 miles away to be all that drastically different. However, today's guest, Shannon Martin, author of The Ministry of Ordinary Places, sits down to discuss how a move with her family just 10 miles away changed everything for them.
This question for me is a no-brainer. So I didn't have to think on this for very long. My one thing that has dramatically reshaped my life would be my neighborhood and my neighbors. So my husband and I and our three kids at the time, we now have four kids, but we moved 6 years ago from a really small rural community. You know, we lived in a farmhouse out on 6 acres, and it was sort of, we were kind of living our dream life at that point. You know, we had always kind of wanted to live in a big white farmhouse. And so we were doing that, and we had the pastures and the orchard and all of those things.
Did you have the animals? I mean,
in a strange twist, we actually had, there was another farmer up the road that asked if he could keep his horses and ponies in our pasture.
Yes.
So we had them, but we didn't have to take care of them. So it was like the best case scenario. I mean, look at them, and the kids would go out and feed them. And I mean, it was just a very lovely situation because it was, you know, zero obligation on our part. So yeah, we kind of did.
That's the only way I could have horses or
I know
any kind of farm animal.
The ponies started to cause trouble because they began escaping. Sometimes who knew ponies could be so, I mean, they were like the little miniature Shetland ponies, and they would get out now and then. And so then I was like forced into this actual farm girl role that I really wasn't good at in practice. So that
chasing
was,
tiny ponies down the country right. Dirt road.
That's right.
That is wonderful. So you are on 6 acres in the dream, living the dream, having the ponies. Yeah. And where do you go from there?
Well, you know, we found ourselves in a situation where my husband and I had both been, you know, that sort of traditional story of we had both been raised really from birth in the church and really deeply in evangelical church culture. And we had done all the things, you know, I was in Awana as a child, and then I was a Bible quizzer, and then I went to Christian college.
Oh yeah. You were on the path.
I was in it. And my husband, you know, he wasn't in, you know, we didn't grow up in the same area, but he lived a very similar childhood.
Okay.
And we actually met at our Christian college. But, you know,
Shannon, I'm sorry to interrupt. Did you do sword drills along the way? Because I have PTSD I was not, you know, I was good at so many things as a child, I like to believe, but sword drills was just not one of them.
Not your jam. You were good at other things.
And if you're out there right now and you're listening and you don't know what sword drills are, thank your parents. Continue on.
we were just kind of in that mode of feeling like we were doing things right. You know, we had good jobs. We both worked in political fields. We had lived out in D.C. for a time and then, you know, had moved back to Indiana and
That adds a whole nother layer, Shannon.
There are so many layers. Yeah. I mean, the story could just go as deep as we wanted to go.
And here we go. We're going deep. Continue on. And I will promise not to interrupt as much as I have.
No, feel free. I don't mind at all. We had great jobs. We were making a good living. We had our kiddos all came to us through adoption. So at the time we had our first two, Calvin and Ruby, and they were just, you know, they were adorable, and we could say that whenever we wanted to because we couldn't take any credit for it. We very much believed that we were living the good Christian life that we were sort of taught, or maybe we had just kind of absorbed it, you know, that this is what life was about. It's about, you know, creating a life for you and especially for your kids that was as safe and comfortable and and peaceful and secure as possible. And that's what we were doing. Oh, you know,
you just use so many words that are nails on a chalkboard, you know? Right. I know, but it sounds so good. But, you know, continue on, safe and comfort. You're living with the ponies.
That's what we were doing. And that's what we believed that it was the right way. For whatever reason, it was just, you know, we were living kind of that quiet, idyllic life in a lot of ways and just, you know, in good standing in our communities. But what we were so in the bubble that we didn't realize that there even was a bubble. And so we were constantly, really for most of our lives, surrounded by people who lived and looked and believed exactly as we did. And that's just one of those things that you just don't quite notice it until you do. And we, through a strange series of events, ended up listening to a sermon series online, which was something we had never done before. And I'm still shocked that we did. That's just not quite the people that we were.
You're not downloading things or you're not tech savvy, or that's just not what we would do at this point.
We were not in a phase of, you know, we had these two toddlers. So we just weren't the kind of people who would say, let's get the kids to bed and then sit down and listen to a sermon series together.
No, I fully understand. You know what I'm saying? Yes. You're preaching my language right now.
Right. I mean, we would watch TV or, you know, read books or do whatever we would do, but we had never done that before. And this was really, you know, this would have been, gosh, 8 to 10 years ago. And so things were just different then. You know, podcasts weren't quite what they are now. And it was just a different thing. It involved us pulling up the link to the sermon series and then huddling around the laptop under the light of the moon while our kids slept and listening to the sermon series that ended up being the book Radical by David Platt. But you know, that book hadn't been written yet. We didn't know who this person was. And this was just the sermon series that never seemed to end. I mean, it went on and on and on. But through the course of that series, we kind of had our eyes open to this really critical part of the gospel that we believed we knew. We believed we really understood the Bible. But then to see that, you know, loving your neighbor, although we'd certainly heard those verses before, but to really start to reflect on, you know, this is a really big deal to the heart of God. And it's especially a big deal to love our neighbors who are not loved enough for whatever reason. So, you know, for whatever reason, they would be sort of on the margins or, you know, suffering in some way. And so we started to really wrestle with a lot of things. I mean, it was a time of great emotional turmoil for us in many ways, because it was just really disrupting everything we had been taught to do.
It was disrupting all of the comfort as it does.
Yeah. And we had to contend with the fact that, you know, the verses throughout the Bible to care for the poor and to care for the oppressed, we just really, if we were being honest, we really didn't know the poor. We really didn't know people who had, you know, vastly different backstories or experiences than we had had. We suddenly came face to face with the fact that we were in fact in a bubble, and that really the large majority of people in our lives were in there with us, and we just didn't know what we didn't know. And so that launched us into a time of a lot of transition, and we did end up, I mean, it certainly didn't happen overnight. It seemed like it was a very slow road, but we ended up moving not far, just 10 miles away, but we moved into a lower income, very ordinary, sort of shabby neighborhood in a nearby city. And that was just the, you know, it felt like it took a lot to get us to where we are now. But in so many ways, the day we got here was the day everything really started to change.
And so I want you to take me back to the, you know, we now have hindsight of that move, and it obviously has affected you in positive ways, which you're going to talk about, and I'm sure has taught you many things. But how risky did it feel to you at that time, disrupting the comfortable, mm-hmm. the safety, the security, the things that you had worked towards? And I know particularly when believers are disrupted in this way, maybe you've experienced this and maybe you haven't, as mm-hmm. we have walked into a community of people with disability, there are those people who cheer you on surrounding right. you and just, man, they get it. And there then again are some other people who think you are absolutely nutty.
That right.
You've read the scripture wrong or something because yeah. you now are redirecting your life. And so what was your own fears as well as the fears of mm-hmm. those around you at this time when you said, I mean, it's 10 miles, right? Like,
right.
Like this, right. this should not be as big as I know it must have felt though.
Yeah. It honestly, it felt like the hugest thing, you know, and we've been here now for 6 years. And so now we can kind of laugh at ourselves. And, but I also have a lot of compassion for us, you know, 6 years ago, because I think anytime we move out of our comfort zone, it is uncomfortable and discomfort is a little scary. And so I, you know, while Corey and I can sort of joke with each other now, like what in the world, like why were we so worried and what were we afraid of? We were afraid of the unknown. And I think that's a really universal feeling. And like you said, we had a lot of, especially there in the beginning, we had a lot of personal fallout, that made it harder. And it was, you know, it was people who, you know, a lot of it was people who really loved us and who were concerned, like you said, that we were getting it wrong. We were missing it. You know, God would surely never ask us to do this strange thing. You know, there was a lot of misunderstanding. There was a lot of loneliness that set in some ways because we just felt so misunderstood by a lot of the people around us. And, you know, part of the move, when we moved into our new neighborhood, our oldest was in second grade, our youngest was in preschool, and then we had a kindergartner. And so, you know, there's the physical move, but then there's also the issue of like, they're changing schools. And that was, you know, we moved out of one of the highest ranked, you know, public schools in Indiana into an elementary school that was, you know, quote, failing at the time. And so there were just a lot of pieces to the puzzle, and every piece just seemed to get a little weirder, you know, a little more like, just when you think the story is not complicated enough, it does get more complicated. And so there were a lot of reasons for people to kind of gravitate towards this feeling of anxiety over the whole thing. And it was, you know, we felt pretty resolute. It was sort of galvanizing for Corey and I in our marriage to realize, you know, it's okay if nobody understands, you know, we can trust that we are hearing from God on this and that our hearts are being led and, you know, it might be lonely, but we've got each other and it's going to be okay. And so we had a lot of those feelings, but you know, it can be also a little, I don't know. It gives this feeling of sort of internal imbalance when you're sort of up against this broad critique over what you're doing, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does make sense. And I feel like you pretty much just laid out a formula for so many people that we've gotten to accompany and that for sure we have experienced ourselves, though it's a different route. It's really kind of the same map. And, you know, you mentioned a disruption, you know, that something mm-hmm. comes in and it just allows you to see with, I don't know if the glasses come on or the glasses go off, but you're
right.
you're suddenly seeing a different way with that disruption. And then there's movement. So from that disruption comes something that you feel as though we're supposed to actually act on it. It's, you know,
yeah.
And then the loneliness, I think that is just one of those common themes when God calls you to, and it's funny that they wouldn't think that God calls you to strange things because the Bible is full of
right.
the weirdest stuff
That's
that
right.
God asked people to do. And yet, you know, we think that picket fences and good succeeding blue ribbon schools is what we're called to. So I absolutely just love kind of that journey that you went on. And as you guys go here, you move in day one into a new neighborhood. Walk me through just... Mm-hmm. What did you begin to learn?
You know, it was a process of just sort of figuring out where specifically we should land. And that just, you know, that just took time and we were impatient, but you can't rush these things. We knew at the point that we were going to move into this particular neighborhood, we knew that we weren't here to do a thing. So we weren't here to plant a church. We weren't here to start a Bible study. We weren't here to start a food pantry. And not that any of those things are bad. And quite honestly, there were many days that I wished that I had a thing, because I think, you know, my history in the church had taught me to be more comfortable if I was, you know, if I had a project to work on,
yeah,
I guess.
Absolutely. Projects, checking boxes is always less right. messy than getting to know people.
Right. And I think in a lot of ways that would have helped some of the people kind of on the sidelines understand. So I think, you know, there was this sentiment of, you know, if you say God has called us to this, you know, this is very churchy language that I'm using intentionally, but if you say God has called me into this, you know, kind of disadvantaged neighborhood to plant a church, people in the church can't really disagree too much with that. You know,
right,
it's kind
right.
of like
you have
a
the Trump card.
Exactly. And we didn't have that card. We didn't have that card to play. And so I think that made it all the more confusing to the people around us. It made it seem more risky because we didn't have this visible banner that they could see of, you know, God's direction or God's leading over our lives.
Well, to continue on the churchy language and discussion, yeah. I believe it was Abraham that was called to go where he didn't know where he was going. And so he mm-hmm. sets off and, you know, there's no destination. And that is so confusing to people.
Right.
When you move towards a question mark.
Right. But like you said, I mean, this story is certainly, it wasn't written for Corey and I. You know, this story is heavy in the rotation throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament of people doing really seemingly bizarre things because they had been led in that direction. But it's so it's funny to know that in your mind, to know that this forms, you know, one of the central tenets, I guess, of the Bible. But then when it's real people and real, you know, when it's your family or when it's your close friends or, you know, it's just harder to understand in our kind of modern paradigm, I think. So we just knew that we were coming here to live as neighbors, which sounds great until you realize that we had never really done that. And in our faith journey had not prepared us in particular for what that meant and what that was going to look like. And, you know, we moved into this very diverse, in every sense of the word, a very diverse community, a very diverse neighborhood, a neighborhood where we almost immediately encountered a lot of suffering and a lot of, you know, people who were just really struggling. And so we realized quickly that we were here to learn from our neighbors, and we were here to love them and to learn what that was really going to look like in just a very ordinary and daily way. But more than that, we were here to be loved by them. And all I can say is, you know, those initial days, they were a little nerve-wracking, I guess. They were very exciting. We felt invigorated in a lot of ways. It was very special because none of our kids are Caucasian. So it was special to suddenly be in a community that, you know, was not all white people. And then, you know, our kiddos, there were a lot of meaningful things that we encountered right away, but we had to learn to sort of tamp down our urge to do things, just to be busy and just to be, like you said, checking off those boxes. We had to start paying attention and really listening to the people around us. And it's so what I know now is that, you know, all of these issues, I guess, or all of these things that circulate in the air around us and that more and more feel really, they just feel difficult and they, you know, things feel fractured and complicated and divided and, you know, all of these things. But once you meet a person and once that person becomes your friend, and then they almost become kind of like an extension of your family, you know, people who are immigrants or people who have been kind of stuck in the criminal justice system or whatever the case may be. You meet these people and you know, they become kind of your people. I mean, it changes everything. It changes the perspective. And so we just started to come to terms with the fact that neighboring looks like very slow work. We had to learn to kind of let go of the expectations that we might have put on things, or, you know, what our ideas of success might look like. We just had to we learned, I guess, really from making mistakes along the way, to just set some of that aside and to really begin to love and stand with the people around us.
Well, I love that. And, you know, as I think about, it sounds to me as though proximity was important to you, because, you know, you moved 10 miles. You obviously could have fold yourself into building relationships or serving at the kitchen, like we talked about.
Yeah.
You could have driven those 10 miles and come back to the white farmhouse and chase ponies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So proximity seems like a big piece of this as you moved into these marginalized community of different people than you. And then posture, as I hear you talk, just your posture of not being a problem solver, not coming as a savior or a fixer or even providing of a program, but coming in kinship or companionship in the posture of a relationship. That is so, that makes for such a great podcast and such a hard life. You know, it just sounds so good, but as we have journeyed into relationships with people with disability, into a community of people with disability, you know, you see very quickly why so much of that world is geared around providing a program. Because relationships are much, much more difficult and require much, much more sacrifice. But the payoff of that is so much more beautiful. And so I resonate with what you have experienced, and we've tasted that in our own way. So fast forward me to now. You have been there 6 years, I believe. Is that right?
How long
have you been there?
That's
years.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Your kids are older. They have experienced this. You, I would guess, are beginning to see ramifications in your family and your children of this move, of this change. And so where is your family today? What are you guys learning and doing and still a part of?
Yeah. You know, a couple of key things happened not long after we moved into the neighborhood. And so these were, you know, it wasn't like a package deal as much as I wish that it could have been. It wasn't like a, you know, like you can buy those bed in a bag situations. I don't know if you know about that.
I'm sorry to say I have no idea what a bed in a bag is, but I'm fascinated. Continue.
Oh, you can buy these things where, like, they call them bed in a bag, and it's like the sheets and the comforter and the pillow.
I don't think this has reached Arkansas yet. We're always a little bit behind, but bed in a bag will be here next year.
I think it might be. I think it's the opposite.
Started it?
No, maybe you didn't start it, but I think I'm like reaching back into history a little bit. I don't know how much of a thing it still is for
whatever
reason.
You tell me about a bed in a bag. I'll believe it.
It's a ready-made kit, basically, and it all matches and it all goes together. And it's just the easiest way, they say. I'm not a fan of the bed in the bag, for the record, but you can do it. And so, you know, our story changed, our lives changed in a lot of ways, but it didn't all happen in a way that, like, you know, it all came together one day and, you know, everything changed, but it all fit together and it matched and it was perfect.
That makes a much better book, Shannon. If you could just lie to us, we'll buy more of your books. All right. Cause I don't want to hear how hard and slow it was.
You don't. Yeah.
Well,
and surprising. I mean, that's the thing. So once we got here, and I'll, you know, let me just fill in a couple of quick details. Soon before we actually, so once we kind of knew that we were probably going to move, we ended up in the midst of all of this sort of internal heart shifting. We brought home our third kiddo. And he was born in South Korea. He was 18 months old. And so we brought him home to the farmhouse, and he was just a grieving, heartbroken baby. And in a lot of ways, we were unprepared for the magnitude of his emotion and his grief. And, you know, I look back on that now and think, you know, he was our first example, and something that we really, we didn't know how much a part of our life this was going to become at that time, but he was our first opportunity to really choose to walk right straight into somebody else's pain rather than, you know, finding ways to kind of detour around it. I mean, you know, he was our son, he was our child, and he was a baby. And, you know, there was no option from a cognitive standpoint, but also, you know, we loved him immediately and he was part of our family, but it was really sort of traumatic to just walk into that pain and heartbreak. And then we did move, and soon after we brought Silas home, my husband and myself, we both had our political jobs. They both ended very abruptly. And so we had all of these pieces of, like, you know, now we bring Silas home. Now my government contract, you know, very out of the blue ended. Now Corey's, you know, the congressman that he worked for very abruptly resigned. I mean, it felt like things were just kind of being sort of swept off of the table of our lives in a lot of ways. And so, you know, by the time we got to Goshen, we felt like we had lived a lifetime of disruption and change. And for us, there was this distinct feeling of God has more for us, but God's more for us is going to look like less. And so it felt like we were losing a lot of things, or we were surrendering a lot of things. Where we had learned to really climb the ladder, we had the ladder really knocked out from underneath us. And so there was just so much that it felt like, you know, when we got to Goshen or to our neighborhood, like, oh, finally, that's, you know, now all of that's done. And now we can just kind of, you know, make this transition. But what we didn't quite know was that we were going to adopt our fourth son not long after moving into the neighborhood. And he was 19 years old at the time, and he was in jail and was soon after sent off to prison. And I mean, you know, families talk about their surprise child, like, well, he was a surprise. Robert was a big surprise, and he was quite literally a big surprise. He's very tall and he's just a big guy. And so he was like the surprise of the century. And then, you know, maybe 6 months to a year after that, my husband became the full-time chaplain of the county jail, which was a huge shift in his career after working in politics for a decade. So there were a lot of pieces.
That is a lot of pieces.
It's
that
a lot.
That is not the bed in the back.
That was
many mailed separate pieces that don't go together.
Like a bunch of Amazon boxes that all arrive at different times.
Stack them up. Well, there had to be along the way, Shannon, as you described that, you know, you seem to do it. We're listening to each other, but you seem to do it with a smile on your face and very positive. But there had to be some real pain in that journey for you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was really difficult, and we were unprepared for the pain of living our lives next to people who are sort of on fire. You know, our lives are just really entangled. And I don't say that word in a negative way at all. I mean, we've really intentionally made our lives very rooted to this place and to these people. And so it is messy, and it is kind of, you know, it's all kind of mixed together and it bleeds together. And I think that's how neighboring should be. I think that's how community should be. But when you're really in close proximity with people whose lives are painful, you end up feeling those contact burns. You know, you feel that heat. You take on some of their heartbreak and some of their heartache, and you take on their isolation in some ways and their trauma in some ways. I mean, I didn't know, I had never experienced that before. And so even with our oldest son, Robert, or with our youngest son, Silas, or with, you know, all of our kids have some adoption wounds. And, you know, you think of the relationships you have and the pain that they carry, and you just, that's what it means to really love someone, is to kind of carry some of that burden on your own shoulders. But we just didn't know what we didn't know. And so it came as a bit of a surprise to us. And it was and still is. I mean, it can be painful. It can be frustrating. It can be sad. But man, it can be overwhelmingly, we feel very lucky. We feel so fortunate to live our lives next to very resilient and generous and optimistic people. And to be loved by them is just a gift that we never knew we needed.
Shannon, you have just put a book out about God in the ordinary places. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you began writing? I know this is not your first book. How you began writing about the journey that you're on?
Yeah, the book that just came out in October is The Ministry of Ordinary Places. And it's really a lot of the things that we're talking about today. So, you know, what does it look like to, no matter where we are, because I want to point out that while proximity to this place was really necessary for us, we have a lot of friends who find creative ways to find proximity and meaningful proximity and meaningful relationships outside of, you know, I'm not advising that everybody needs to sell their house and move, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
So regardless of where we might find ourselves, what would it mean if we all decided to get very intentional to say, okay, wherever we are right now, we've been placed here for a reason, even if we don't quite understand what that reason is, but like there's a purpose here. And, you know, this is our place and these are our people. And this is where God is alive and, you know, wildly at work around us. We can choose to be a part of that. We can choose to see it, or we can, you know, pretend that everything is just on fire. But what would it look like to really start paying attention to our one tiny speck of a corner of this world and walk into the pain and walk into the celebration and just kind of lock arms with the people around us and, you know, spend time in our neighbors' homes and keep our own door really easy on its hinges. I mean, we have neighbors and friends in and out of our home frequently. We have times where they live with us, but more often we have people over for meals all the time or just to hang out. We just had a really eclectic group of people over for Thanksgiving. And we started to understand that in kind of the, you know, up in the atmosphere, whether you want to say, you know, politics or religion or, you know, all of these big issues that just seem pretty complex and pretty disheartening in a lot of ways, when we bring our eye down to street level, right where we are, and we find somebody who might not be loved well enough, and we just dig in right there, you know, making the world better for one person makes the world better. And so if a whole bunch of us did that, then the world would get a whole lot better. And it sounds kind of basic, but I just really, truly believe it. And I've seen this in our own lives and in the lives around us. And so that's kind of the heartbeat of the second book.
As you call people, Shannon, kind of into the experience of pain and suffering, if that's alongside of others or sharing that burden, as you call people into that, what would you say to the person who's just not there? And, you know, you said you have tremendous compassion and grace for you 8 years ago, or who you were, you know, before this was where you felt like you were headed. What would you say to the person that just, they hear you and they say, man, that is so good for you. and we experience this quite a bit because I am convinced that the best experiences of my life, the closest, most vivid experiences of Christ in my life have been in the midst of the suffering and the pain, both of myself that we've walked through,
right,
and of being in that with others. And yet, having had that reality and having experienced that, there is still an absolute distancing from pain that I have to remind myself, oh, yeah, wait, you know, this is not simply just to be avoided, but there is beauty in experiencing these things, both in myself and in others. But as you say, you have compassion for yourself before, as I say, gosh, I don't know that I can ever convince anybody that that's the, you know, like I said, it's much easier to sell the 10 steps to your best life.
Right.
What do you have to say to the person that says, you know, I'm just not there, and I'm not sure that the picket fence isn't for me?
Right. You know, for one thing, I think Jesus very clearly promises us pain. And I think his promises are gifts to us, whether they appear that way, you know, on their face or not. And so I completely agree with everything you just said, that there's something powerful to be learned as we experience suffering and, you know, the dependence on God that it creates within us, and even the dependence that it creates with us and the people around us when we just literally need help and we need support. And, you know, I think it's a beautiful thing. But I also think Christians like to talk about, you know, living the abundant life. We like those words. We like the sound of abundance.
We're drunk with it.
Yeah. But, you know, I think abundance means all of it. That's what abundance means. Like, you get it all. It doesn't mean that you get what we would see with our human eyes as just the good things. It doesn't mean excess in the ways that we would like it to mean excess. It means you get a little bit of everything. And so while the picket fence life might sound great, I mean, I just know the depth and the richness of infusing life with the suffering of other people and with the sorrow of those around us, and with really coming to a place that you can look brokenness, you know, the brokenness of the world around us and you know, the lives that are marginalized around us and, you know, treated unfairly, and to really come to a place that you can look that dead in the eye and then say, okay, even if there's nothing I can do to fix this, I can stand, I can choose where I stand, and I can choose to stand with the people who are left lonely, and I can choose to stand with the people who are rebuilding their lives after incarceration and battling addiction. I mean, I wish I had the solution to meth addiction, and I don't have it. It turns out I can't fix that. But walking through hard times with our brothers and sisters, I mean, it's just, that is abundance. That is the, you know, the salted chocolate is kind of how I refer to it in the book. It's like that sweetness with the bitterness, and it's, you know, this is what I believe the abundant life to be now. It means that we get all of it.
Well, thank you to Shannon Martin for that discussion and that challenge. Thank you also to you for listening and tuning in. If you liked it, share it. Maybe go on and write a little review for us. Just take us viral. Tell the world how much you're loving it. As always, you could find show notes and links at theatypicallife.com. We will be linking to Shannon's writing, where you could find that, as well as where you could find your way to her books. Thank you also to 99 Balloons, the sponsor of the One Thing series. You can find out more about how to sponsor a child with disability to attend school through their all-in sponsorship program at 99balloons.org. We love you. Have a great week.